Section 2 of The Testament of Beauty by Robert Bridges. This Legimus recording may be freely used and adapted as long as Legimus and the reader are credited. Book 1, Introduction, Part 2. Seeking unceasingly for the first cause of all, in question for what special purpose he was made, man, in the unsearchable darkness, knoweth one thing, that as he is, so was he made. And if the essence and characteristic faculty of humanity is our conscient reason and our desire of knowledge, that was nature's purpose in the making of man. But can there be any will or purpose in nature? That universe external to our percipient sense, which when we examine itself we think only to find a structure of blind atoms to their habits enslaved, or else, examining our senses, suspect to be a dream of empty appearance and vain imagery. As a man through a window into a darkened house, peering vainly, will see, always and easily, the glass surface and his own face mirrored thereon, though looking from another angle, or hooding his eyes, he may discern some real objects within the room. Some say 'tis so with us, and also affirm that they, by study of their reflection, have discovered in truth there is nothing but that same reflection inside the house. See how they have made of the window an impermeable wall, partitioning man off from the rest of nature, with stronger impertinence than science can allow. Man's mind, nature's entrusted gem, her own mirror cannot be isolated from her other works by self-abstraction of its unique fecundity in the new realm of his transcendent life. Not emotion or imagination, ethic or art, logic of science or dialectic discourse, not even that supersensuous sublimation of thought, the heuristic vision of mathematical trance, hath any other foundation than the common base of nature's building. Not even his independence of will, his range of knowledge, and spiritual aim can separate him off from the impercipient, although his mind be such that it might seem as if true individuality within the species were peculiar to man. So foolish is he, and wise, despondent and hopeful, patient and complaining, courageous and cowardly, diffident and vain, cringing and commanding, industrious and idle, cruel and tender-hearted, truthful and perfidious, imaginative or dull. One man, how lovable, another, how hateful, alike man, brutal or divine. Whereamong hath the sceptic honourable place, that old iconoclast, who could destroy the gods, soon as men made them, vain imagery and unworthy, low symbols of the eternal that standeth unchanged. Like some medicinal root in pharmacy, whose juice is wholesome for purgation, so is he. And if truth be that which omniscience could assert of all things, we may grant him his motto, truth is not for man. But from his sleepy castle he will be tempted forth, if ever a hunting horn echo in the woods around. For he loveth the chase, and, like a good sportsman, his hounds and his weapons, as he loveth the prey. So musing all my days with unceasing wonder, and encountering many phases of many minds, through kindly environment of my disposition I grew, as all things grow, in the pattern of self, till, stumbling early upon the mystic words, whereby, in the Semitic matrix of my father's creed, Yahweh revealed his secret being to the Jews, and conning those large letters, I am that I am, I wondered, finding only my own thought of myself, and reading there that man was made in God's image, knew not yet that God was made in the image of man, nor the profounder truth that both these truths are one. No quibbling scoff, for surely as mind in man groweth, so with his manhood groweth his idea of God, wider ever and worthier, until it may contain and reconcile in reason all wisdom, passion, and love, and bring at last, may God so grant, Christ's peace on earth. Nor could it ever dwell in my possible thought that whatsoever grew and groweth can be unlike in cause and substance to the thing it groweth on. Thus I saw conscience as the natural flower bud on its vigorous plant specialized to a function marvellously, a blossom, first unique in design of beauty, in colour and form, thickening therefrom to a fruit productive to infinite regeneration. And yet this bud, as any primer of botany can teach, is but a differentiation of the infertile leaf, which held all this miracle in intrinsic potence. Thus science would teach, and Heraclitus, I say, was not the least among the sages of Hellas, nor those fire-worshippers foolish, who, seeing the sun to be the efficient cause of all life upon earth, welcomed his full effulgence for their symbol of God. And since we observe in all existence four stages, atomic, organic, sensuous, and self-conscient, and must conceive these in gradation, it was no flaw in Leibniz to endow his monad atoms with mind, though in our schools of thought unconscious mind is called a contradiction in terms, as if the embranglements of logic were the prime condition of all being, the essence of things. And man, in the toilsome journey from conscience of nothing to conscient ignorance, mistook his tottery crutch for the main organ of life. 'Tis laughable that man should fondle such surprise at animal behaviour, seeing some beetle or fly, whose very existence is so negligible and brief, act more intelligently than he might himself, had he been there to advise, with all his pros and cons, his cause, effect, and means. Such conduct he will style marvels of instinct. But what sort of wisdom is this that mistaketh the exception for the general rule, and the rule for the exception? Since the animal world immeasurably outnumbereth the species of man, and wholly is ruled by instinct, 'tis the reason of man that is the exception and marvel. Nay, 'tis plain to see how, as our life is animal, so also our conduct is mainly instinctive, while pure reason, left to herself, relieth on axioms and essential premises, which she can neither question nor resolve, things far beyond her, holding her anchor in eternal mind, characteristic universals, the firm rock whereon her lofty watchtowers are planted, and all her stargazing observatories built. Wise thinkers do homage to good fellow-thinkers, nor disregard the general common sense of man, that untouched photograph of external nature, self-pictured for us nakedly on her own mirror. And though common opinion may be assent in error, there is little or none accord in philosophic thought. This pick-lock reason is still a fumbling at the wards, bragging to unlock the door of stern reality. Ask what is reasonable. See how time and clime conform mind more than body in their environment. What then and there was reason is here and now absurd. What I now chance to approve may be or become to others strange and unpalatable, as now appear to me the weighty sentences of the angelic doctor. For I rank it among the unimaginables how St. Thomas, with all his honesty and keen thought, toiling to found an irrefragable system of metaphysic, ethic, and theologic truth, should, with open eyes, have accepted for main premise the myth of a divine fiasco, on which to assure the wisdom of God, leading to a foregone conclusion of illacrimable logic, a monstrous scheme, horrendum informe lingens cui lumen ademptum. Some would say that the saint himself held not the faith which universal credit compelled him to assume if he would lead and teach the church. But so to think, as though 'twas but the best gambit to open his game, were to his acumen and his honesty alike unjust. I am happier in surmising that his vision at Mass, in Naples it was, when he fell suddenly in trance, was some disenthrallment of his humanity. For thereafter, whether 'twere Aristotle or Christ, that had appeared to him then, he never more wrote word, neither dictated, but laid by inkhorn and pen, and was as a man out of hearing on that day when Reinaldus, with all the importunity of zeal and intimacy of friendship, would have recalled him to his incompleted summa. And sighing, he replied, "I will tell thee a secret, my son, constraining thee, lest thou dare impart it to any man while I live. My writing is at end. I have seen such things revealed that what I have written and taught seemeth to me of small worth. And hence I hope, in my God, that, as of doctrine, there will be speedily also an end of life." There is no tradition among the Lemmings of Norway how their progenitors, when their offspring increased, bravely forsook their crowded nesties in the snow, swarming upon the plains to ravage field and farm, and in unswerving course ate their way to the coast, where, plunging down the rocks, they swam in the salt sea to drowning death. Nor have they in acting thus to-day any plan for their journey or prospect in the event. But clerks and chroniclers were many in Christendom, when France and Germany poured out the rabblement of the Second Crusade, and its record is writ. Its leaders' titles, kings and knights of fair renown, their resolve and design. And yet, for all their vows, their consecrating crosses and embroidered flags, the eloquent preaching of St. Bernard, and the wiles of that young amorous Amazon, Queen Eleanor, they were impelled as madly, journeyed as blindly, and perished as miserably as the thoughtless voles, by disease, starvation, and massacre, or enslaved by wrath of the folk whose homes they had wrecked and ravaged, till of the unnumbered rout a poor remnant fled back, the shame of humanity for their folly and crimes. Reason, shamefast at heart and vain above measure, would look to find the first fruits of intelligence showing some provident correction of man's estate towards social order, a wise discriminate purpose in clear contrast against the blind habits of brutes. And when our honest hope turneth away, repelled by the terror and superstition of savagery, wherein nascent reason seemeth to have hoodwinked mind, if we read but of Europe since the birth of Christ, 'tis still incompetent disorder, all a lecture of irredeemable shame. The wrongs and sufferings alike of kings and clowns are a pitiful tale. Follow the path of those fair warriors, the tall Goths, from the day when they led their blue-eyed families off Vistula's cold pasture lands, their murky home by the amber-strewn foreshore of the Baltic Sea, and in the incontaminate vigour of manliness, feeling their rumoured way to an unknown promised land, tore at the ravelled fringes of the purple power, and, trampling its wide skirts, defeating its armies, slaying its emperor, and burning his cities, sacked Athens and Rome, until, supplanting Caesar, they ruled the world where Romans reigned before. Yet from those 3 long centuries of rapine and blood, inhumanity of heart and wanton cruelty of hand, there is little left save the broken relic of 1 good bishop and the record of 1 noble king, who both had sucked their virtue from the withered dugs of learning, where she lay sickening within the walls of rich Byzance. Those Goths were strong but to destroy. They neither wrote nor wrought, thought not nor created. But since the field was rank with tares and mildewed wheat, their scything won some praise. Else have they left no trace, save for their share in that rich mingled character of Hebrew, Roman, Vandal, Mussulman, and Celt, that spoke the pride of Spain, to stand for ever alive in 1 grandesque effigy of ennobled folly, among fair beauty's fairest offspring unreproved. Yet for this intellectual laughter, deem it not true wisdom's panoply. The wise will live by faith in the order of nature, and that her order is good. 'Twere scepticism in them to cherish make-believe, creeds, and precise focusings of the unsearchable. At such things they may smile. Yet for man's ignorance and frailty, the only saving consolation is faith, the which theologians tell us is the gift of God, as other good things are, and laughter is one of them. And sharing of man's essence, 'twill be at height in him when 'tis the laughter of reason, enjoyable. And 'tis fit that he should show nature this courtesy, and kindly make light of all the troubles that compel no tears. Cervantes in misfortune, when a galley slave, wept not. But where sorrow is sacred, humour is dumb, and in full calamity it is madness. Wherefore Hamlet himself would never have been aught to us, or we to Hamlet, were it not for the artful balance whereby Shakespeare so gingerly put his sanity in doubt, without the while confounding his reason. And though desire of perfection is nature's promise, we should not in the field of reason look to find, less vary and veer than elsewhere in the flux of life. We may rather rejoice in the great abundance, the indigenous fruitage of our gay paradise, that Persia, China, and Babylon put forth their bloom, that India and Egypt were seed plots of wisdom. The best part of our lives we are wanderers in romance. Our fathers travelled eastward to revel in wonders, where pyramid pagoda and picturesque attire glow in the fading sunset of antiquity. And now will the Orientals make hither in return outlandish pilgrimage. Their wiseacres have seen the electric light of the west, and come to worship, tasting romance in our unsightly novelties and scientific tricks. For all things in their day may have opinion of glory. Glory is opinion, the vain doxology wherewith man would praise God. Time eateth away at many an old delusion, yet with civilization delusions make head. The thicket of the people will take furtive fire from irresponsible catchwords of live ideas, sudden as a gauze bush from the smouldering end of any loiterer's match splint, which, unless trodden out afore it spread, or quelled with wieldy threshing rods, will burn 10 years of planting with all last year's ricks and blacken a countryside. 'Tis like enough that men, ignorant of fire and poison, should be pre-condemned to sudden deaths and burnings. But 'tis mightily to the reproach of reason that she cannot save nor guide the herd, that minds, who else were fit to rule, must win to power by flattery and pretence, and so by spiritual dishonesty in their flurried reign confirm the disrepute of all authority. But only in sackcloth can the muse speak of such things. End of section 2.